The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. David Pelkowitz, who occupies the Strauss Chair in Jewish Education at both Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration and Stern College for Women. Dr. Pelkowitz was previously a clinical professor of psychology at New York University School of Medicine and director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Pelkowitz is also a near and dear friend of Priority Ones of the Yeshivas. He's been committed and dedicated to our population, to our kids, and kids at large, just for forever. And he's always there for us, and we always appreciate his help. No further ado, Dr. Pelkowitz.
So thank you. I think I know what I'm going to say, but I want to, let me get a sense as to, I want to go with where the audience is at in terms of focus. I know the topic tonight is uniqueness, and I want to talk about it. There are a lot of different ways of approaching it, but let me just hear from you. What are some of the areas you'd like me to focus on in terms of your needs in the classroom or with the kids you're working with or whatever? Is there any like pressing area you'd like me to focus on? You got it. Okay. So let's hear. Yes.
Sometimes you have a student who is doing so poorly in school that he doesn't believe that he can do well, and he's involved in a lot of self-destructive behavior, which doesn't allow the Rebbe, the teacher, to help the child out because the child is convinced that he's never getting anywhere.
Okay. So when you say self-destructive behavior, what do you mean?
I mean, he will find reasons or excuses for his misbehavior, such as disrupting class or finding reasons why he won't do well in class. They can blame it on anything else but his own brains. Whether it's that he spends all day in the bathroom or he cuts class, gets kicked out, does other things to show, you know, finds a disturbance in the class, something disturbing him, he can't study, he just does everything that should not do well.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's dealing with the sort of like this, a child who's the disruptive child. Okay. I hear you. Okay. What else? Yes.
We can't hear anything with this lower. We don't hear enough background.
Okay.
Turn that off or no?
No, don't turn it off.
You'd rather be cool and deaf than be able to hear. Thanks. Okay. I'm gonna talk loud. Once I get started, I'll talk loud. What I asked before is, before I start, I just want to make sure I'm focusing on what you're most interested in. So let me hear what else. Any other areas of focus you'd like me? Somebody already asked me to focus on classroom management of the disruptive child. Okay, yes?
A slight variation. The child who comes in with a reputation, you don't see anything overt, but you feel the effects of it socially. The child is socially isolated. And once a minasmino winds up with the other person with that reputation, do you ignore it? Do you...
So how do you deal with repetitive patterns? Like you were saying, the kid is so locked into...
Yeah, that's overt as opposed to...
Where it's more subtle. Okay, good. Yeah.
What about you have a child being almost being like, nothing matters to them. You can't get through to them. You can't even punish them. Like anything you try to do them, anything, you have nothing to do with them.
So it's like insensitivity to punishment. Okay. Now you're speaking mostly about high school level, middle school level? Okay. How many of you are educators of adolescents? How many of you are mechanchim or mechanchas with pre-adolescents? Okay. Good. Anything else before I move on? Don't worry, we'll have plenty of time for question and for give and take. Yes?
It's a little bit different topic. The children that will communicate their problems, what is considered effective having, you know, sympathizing, having conversations about the kids' problems, how far should we go to try to solve these problems, and is it effective if the kid just loves to share their problems but never really tries to solve
good.
Them?
Good. Okay, so communication and boundaries and what your role is, and is it enough to just listen? Good. Yeah.
Let me answer that one. A lot of big issues come up when a student starts to talk to you legally. How much can you let the child tell you before you have to speak up about it?
I mean, guidelines on confidentiality, I mean, basically.
That a student's going to tell you about drugs or something else like that?
Right, right. Yeah, that I'm not, I mean, obviously I'm not an attorney, but it's interesting to talk about. Okay, I like that one. Yeah.
How do you deal with problems in the home, alcoholism, spouse beating?
Good. Okay, good. Okay, let me take one more from the men and then two more from the women and then we'll get started. Yeah. Okay, so the negative attention kids. Okay, and yes.
How do you deal with parents who are either in denial about what you're trying to share with them, or just not on board? How do you get the parents on board?
Right. Okay. Good. Very good. Let's get going. Here goes. Let me just. Most of you have as students boys or girls? Just a couple. I'm going to skip most of the initial stuff. But in terms of girls, I'll just say something. You know it, but I might as well say it. What I wanted to, it's as good a place as any to start. The research in the secular world shows that if a girl develops a serious behavior problem, her long-term prognosis is not as positive as it is with a boy. And in our community, it's probably a kal v'chomer. And what I mean by that is that in general, behavior problems in kids come in two flavors. There's garlic and there's onion, right? So garlic, as the head of child psychiatry at UCLA used to say, those are the kids who make everybody else miserable. They themselves are fine. They make that garlic is they push people away with their obnoxious behavior. And those are the kids with disruptive behavior, etc. Onion are the kids who are themselves miserable. They're depressed, they're anxious, they themselves are crying, okay? Girls who have serious problems with their behavior are overriding what's natural. In the general population, girls tend to be onion specialists, and boys tend to be garlic specialists. Now, of course, you could have it both ways. You could have depressed boys, you could have acting out girls. But the theory is that once girls override their natural tendency towards onion and become garlic, it speaks to a more serious underlying problem. So it's possible, at least is what the research suggests in terms of the long-term studies in the secular world of girls who have serious problems with behavior. So, for example, girls who might be delinquent, girls with serious conduct problems, serious problems with disruptive behavior, we know that if you follow them into adulthood, they don't tend to do as well as the boys. Many of the boys do tshuva, many of the boys come back in the general world. But the long-term prognosis for girls is once they become garlic, it's harder for them to come back in terms of long-term adjustment. Is it impossible? No, but it's harder. Now, you put on top of that our unique world. And in our unique world, where it's a little tougher for girls. It's a little tougher for girls in terms of we're a little less forgiving of girls. I'm going to have to be careful. I'm standing right in front of Naran Kodesh. I won't speak quite as openly as I would otherwise in terms of I have to, I guess, have a different standard of what I speak about. But what I want to say is that, that with girls, we know that, first of all, there are fewer options. There are fewer alternative schools for them. Thankfully, this community is an exception. But it's very unusual. If you call around the world and ask for, are there specialized programs for girls who develop, serious behavior problems, the answer is that there are far fewer than there are for boys. And as a result, they could go from 0 to 100 much more quickly. So, and that has implications. That means for those of you who are mainstream educators, so the mainstream people, you have to think, it becomes dinei nefashos much more quickly when you're asking a girl to leave a high school. I mean, that's just, I'm saying the obvious, but I think it's an important thing to think about. And that's what this first slide is here. There are fewer alternative schools for these girls, making it more likely that their behavior leads to their expulsion from yeshiva high school. They'll be further marginalized from the community. What's the tzad hashava of all of these kids? You've heard it before, but I might as well say it again. The tzad hashava, by way of introduction, of kids who are having serious behavior problems that stay and where they start to elude our protective shield, is that their uniqueness is not somehow being nurtured. I know that any time I go to a special program on at-risk kids, I know that there's a tendency on the part of when let's say you have, as there have been in some priority one weekends, you'll have a group of 7, 8, 9 kids who have become totally alienated, and you have them stand up on a stage and talk about what brought them to that point. And what you hear over and over again is a somewhat different story, but the tzad hashava always is, be it a boy, be it a girl, is that something happened to marginalize them, something happened to make them feel like they don't belong. The research shows that they fall into, there's usually 4 or 5 common categories. One is kids with early kriya problems. Okay, those of you who are educators of younger kids, there's some new research that's been coming out that shows that if you have a problem with kriya, I'm not talking about English reading. If you're an elementary school kid, and you have a problem with reading Hebrew, it puts you at risk for being at risk. You know, my Rebbe, for a number of years, I was very privileged to have Rav Palm, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, as my Rebbe in Tarvadas, about 4 or 5 years. And he used to talk about how when we see a child suffering and we choose not to pay attention and deal with it, he used to say, among the many problems with that is that we're over on the lav of ha'alama. We're over on the lav of the hisalamta mayhem, right? You can't look the other way when you see somebody suffering. And what's the end of that pasuk? Hakem takem imo. The end of that pasuk is you have to stand by them. You have to support them. What the new research is showing us is one of the ways that we have to be hakem takem mimo in terms of dealing with this issue. You all talked at the beginning about the disruptive child, about the child that escapes our hug, okay? We know that part of it is keep your eyes open. Don't look the other way. When you see a child with a kriya problem, in a boy in particular, it's a common pathway because so much of what makes you feel part of the kehillah, it's all about being part of the kehillah, is facility in kriya. It may not seem obvious, but that's one of the ways. What are the other ways that kids feel marginalized? Abuse. A very, very high percentage of the kids that we're working with who have had problems with being at risk have a problem with abuse. A colleague of mine, Shimon Russell, who does a lot of work with these kids in Lakewood and in Yerushalayim, he has a girl, a school for at-risk girls in Yerushalayim. Many of them have been homeless. Many of them come from Bnei Brak. They come from Yerushalayim. And he found them literally homeless on the streets. And he did a very interesting thing. He took a checklist that we developed at Nefesh with a list of all the risk factors for developing serious behavior problems. And he did a very smart thing. He asked all the girls in his school, how old were you when you knew you had this problem? How old were you when you knew you had a reading problem? How old were you when you knew that you had a problem with your family? How old were you when you knew that you had a problem with whatever it was? We'll go through the list in a minute. And then he asked, the second column was, how long was it before any adult in your life knew that you had this problem? And he never really systematically analyzed the results, but I went through the data just eyeballing it between 4 and 5 years on average. That means that these girls on average, we're suffering with the situation of abuse, let's say. We're suffering with the situation of terrible family problems. We're suffering with the situation of being depressed. And everybody either didn't see it because it was invisible, and it's more likely to be invisible in girls. Okay, so the possibility of ha'alama is greater in girls because girls are onion specialists. And it's harder to see onion. You smell garlic much easier. Okay? So we have to hold on to that. It's more likely than boys to present with behaviors that may elude early detection. So it may start with eating disorders. Depression. On average, an untreated depression will not show itself in behavior problems early on. But on average, 4 to 5 years later, that untreated depressed girl or depressed boy is turning to substances to self-medicate and to feel better. Early detection of depression is a very important part of dealing with this problem in terms of those of you who are educators of kids at younger ages, or even those of you who are educators of kids in a middle school or high school level. Okay? And by the way, the research clearly shows the earlier you treat depression, the better the long-term prognosis. Same thing with substance abuse. Yes? Okay, so depression is, in a way, I have a whole PowerPoint on that. But the way, and I think I gave a talk here very recently in Share on diagnosing depression. The bottom line is it's the same way you do it in adults, which is basically it's problems in three areas of functioning. Problems in cognition. So on the thinking, think of three channels, okay? On the thinking channel, it's thinking badly about yourself, feeling like you're garbage, feeling that you're terrible, feeling that you have no future. That's on that channel. Then it's on the feeling channel, feeling sad, blue, down in the dumps for most of the day, more days than not. That's one of the most common kinds of depression. And then it's on the physical channel, stomach aches, headaches without any known cause. Trouble sleeping, trouble concentrating. Now, here's the trick. The problem is that it'll often show itself in school not with the onion of depression, but in adolescence it often shows itself with irritability, withdrawal, and lack of concentration. So you think it's won't when really it's can't. And that's the key. Embedded in some of your questions earlier on was an assumption, okay, this kid is doing it because he or she wants to get attention. They're doing this because of your theories are good theories. And there may be a component of it that's true. But you have to understand that there's a complexity to adolescent behavior that it's important to tease out and to peel away. Because the way we deal with those kids, if we're going to be effective, we have to look at some of the subtle issues. And sometimes the subtle issue is that it's an underlying depression. So now, there are clear criteria. The main thing to look at is that sometimes it'll look in a way that the kid's being obnoxious, and it's more that the kid is hurting, okay? So it may show itself with a behavior problem where what's underneath it is terrible depression. I've seen some girls in some of the local high school here who had terrible problems with cutting, with, you know, wrist cutting, with being very difficult in terms of being non-compliant and terrible students in spite of their being bright. And I'd see them, and it would become very clear that they were clinically depressed. That was a big part of what was going on. Now, sure, there's other stuff going on, but a big part was there. By the way, if you're clinically depressed, you're not going to make a good friend, so you're going to have social problems. Kids are going to reject you. And it becomes a vicious cycle. Your family is going to be very upset because you're not trying, and you're difficult. You're not helping around the house. But the primary thing is one of the girls I'm thinking of right now, she was put on antidepressants, which isn't the answer to everything, but she was put on antidepressants, and everything went away within a couple of months. She stopped cutting. She stopped needing to cut. Cutting was the self-soothing. And she started being happier, and she started making friends, and her grades went from 70s to 90s. So it's not always that miraculous, as we know, but sometimes it's as simple as that. Okay. So the last thing on girls, I already said as much as I want to say on girls, okay? So the commonality goes like this. It's that Sometimes it's the academic problems. Sometimes it's kids just falling into bad peer relationships. Sometimes it's problems at home. It very often is. And then the question is, I hope we'll be able to spend some time talking about what's underneath that. And sometimes it's the self-concept that's problematic, but that comes. What's the self-concept? It's the mirrors held up to yourself. It's the reflected appraisals of others. It's what's bounced back to you. If what's bounced back to you because of undiagnosed learning disability or an undiagnosed psychiatric problem or an undiagnosed problem with the family or with abuse, if what's bounced back to you is repeated failure, you're going to feel lousy about yourself. Okay? Now, by the way, everything I'm talking about, don't get depressed, okay? Don't get, because there's a solution for everything. The good news is the community is dealing with it. Okay? We're giving words. We're naming the monster. I'm going to talk about that a little later when I address the question that was raised about communication, because I have very strong feelings about that. Okay. Let me just do a little bit of underlying stuff. It's just interesting. You know, because we have to understand, in light of the famous Gemara on B'ikvus of the Mashiach, Chutzpah Yaske, there's some interesting stuff coming out here. If you look at it, we really are in a generation that has a harder time setting limits. There's really a sea change. The most common topic I'm asked to speak about in parenting lectures anywhere in this country has to do with limit setting. It has to do with limit setting. Those of you who've heard me speak before know that I talk about the ideal from psychology, and more importantly, the ideal from Divrei Chazal, compared to what's dominating in this country. What's dominating in this country is we are very good at loving our kids, although that's not always the case. We are not very good at putting limits on our kids, and that's a big problem. So what I'll asking you all for forgiveness if it's too repetitive. Let's just chazer it. We know that the key to healthy parenting is the middle, okay? It's what psychologists call authoritative parenting. Authoritative parenting is the middle between authoritarian, which is a rigid, all rules, all no's, and we all know that's not good. Rules without relationships equals rebellion, okay? All rules is not good. The other extreme is all love, no limits, okay? All hugs. All love, no limits, kids will wither up and just not do well. If we could construct a world for kids where we never have to frustrate them and never have to say no to them, it's going to be a big problem. Those kids, you're going to have a generation of kids who don't have discipline, who never grow, who never become a mensch, don't know how to be empathic, etc. The ideal is the middle between love and limits, okay? Or as it was said much more brilliantly by Chazal, in a number of times in Shas, in Sanhedrin, among other places, it says that the key to raising children is finding the balance between smoldoche v'imim makareves. And my favorite image for that, as I said in Share not too long ago, is what Rav Simcha Wasserman said. He said, what happens if you put into play what the Gemara tells us in dealing with a child, and you literally put into play the balance of smoldoche v'imim makareves? You take a child, you could try this in class tomorrow, okay? And you simultaneously push them away with one hand while bringing them closer with another, Rav Wasserman said, you turn them around. You could try it, okay? You turn them around. So that's the key. Huh?
You turn them to the right, too.
You turn them to the right, too. Interesting. Okay. that's debatable, but yeah, you could say that. You could say that. Okay. It could be. Could be. You're turning them to the right, right? Right? Small dochim im karevis, it's the right flip. It's right. It's interesting. By the way, it's the stronger hand, okay? It's the stronger hand that's the hand that gives the hug, okay? It's the weaker hand. But you know something? You raise the kid with the left hand, it's not good either. But you need that left hand even though it's the weaker hand. Okay, so here's some just quick statistics. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's just we have to understand what's the default set. What's the environment? We're too close to it to see it. I was in Sri Lanka in January. I was asked to go there. I was working with a survivor, with the tsunami people. So I was training the doctors who were working with the tsunami. My main area is trauma in the secular world. So it's fascinating because you see a different culture and you learn all kinds of things. I learned so much more to take that we, things that we take for granted that we have to be so grateful for in this country. I don't mean at a physical level, although it's that also. They don't have basic things we take for granted. You don't even realize. We don't even realize. You know, there I gave some kids a dollar, and I think I felt like literally I was saving their lives, because with that dollar it fed them for who knows how long in certain parts of the country that are still not recovered from the tsunami. But it's very interesting. There are a certain number of words that that different cultures specialize in for different reasons. So, for example, they told me that the word anger, when I was working with the doctors, the word anger, they have like, I don't know, something like 30 words for the word anger. All these different in their language, in Sinhalese. And it was fascinating. He said, so give me an example. Like, what's the worst you have? The worst you have? Because I figured, wow, these must be a pretty, and they were very gentle people. So I say, yeah, I really want to hear about the worst adolescent rebellion. Tell me about the really bad anger. So they said, well, they said, so one of the psychiatrists raises her hand and she says, well, you know, last week I had a patient in my office. Her mother asked her to do something and she said, no. I said, okay. I said, yeah, I thought, okay, that's the mildest. So I said, no, I want the worst. The worst. I want, if you have 30 words, I want the word for number 30. She said, I just told you. I said, her mother asked her to do something, and she said no. And everyone, all the doctors are nodding their heads, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, wow, okay? And, you know, do you know that in, so adolescent rebellion is very different depending on where you are. Limit setting is very different on depending on where you are. I was thinking that in the bush of South America, in the rainforest, where it's always green. You know, the trees are so tall, you don't see the sun. So all you see around you is green. There's no word for green in that culture. There's no word for green. Why? They never experience not green. And I was thinking about, and this is a total, I could go off on this. It's actually very relevant to this topic, but I'll control myself. We don't have that much time. But I was thinking about, what word, when you think about nuanced words in Yiddishkeit, there's something that we have a lot of words for. I was thinking about it. They only have one in Sri Lanka. There's a word that we have a lot of words for, and think about why. You know what word we have? Simcha. Simcha, right? What do we have? We have Gila, Ditsa, Rina, Chet, right? We have that. We have Sasam, we have Simcha. We have a million words for Simcha, okay? And each one means something different. You ever see the Vilna Gaon on the difference between Sasam and Simcha? It's very interesting. And there are all kinds of fascinating mefarshim on the little nuances, the nuanced differences. And why is that? Why is that? I don't know, but I'll say one thing. I have all kinds of theories about it. We are, and this is relevant in a million ways, because by the way, part of the answer to the problem is we have to bring simcha into the lives of our children. And if everything is a cookie cutter approach, and if everything is sort of like you have to fit the regular, you know, sort of box. Otherwise, there's no room to make, you know, to push a little bit. It's going to be very hard for them. Many of our kids who we work with who have problems talk about the lack of simcha. They talk about the lack of joy when, in fact, we have a religion that should be filled with joy. It's about joy and about what real simcha is, which is shem moach. It's connecting us to meaning. It's a fascinating topic. I could go on and on about simcha. It's one of my favorite topics, but I'll control myself. That's part of it. It's uniqueness. My father, evidently, who's the Rav of the White Shul for, about 50 years or so. So my father said in a drasha not too long, I think Rosh Hashanah before last, he was talking about just the difference in the boxes we build. He said that when he was in Torah V'das, many, many years ago, okay, when he was in Torah V'das, they used to take, the boys didn't have money. People were very poor then, right? It was the time of the Depression, of the economic depression. They used to take the boys for suits, Erev Rosh Hashanah. And there was like a rich guy on the board of Torah V'das. He used to go to the Lower East Side, and they used to go for suits. And he said, and guys would pick out suits. Everybody was allowed to pick out one suit, and that would be their suit for the year. They couldn't afford. Who could afford? My grandfather, Al Hashem, was a Rav. A Rav in a... You know, they didn't get paid much money much money then at all, you know. Now it may be a little better, I don't know. But so he said, you know what they would pick out? He said you had to understand what the Tarva Das Beis Medrash looked like in the age of Rav Hyman and Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich and all of those Gedolim going back then. He said everybody would pick out a white suit. You pick out a white suit. That's what people wore. Okay? And it's like a metaphor. I'm thinking about sort of like it's become so much more difficult to even, you know, to even veer or drop away. It's part of the problem. It's part of the problem. But anyway, I won't bore you with too much on that. But let me just go to this. Look at this stuff. And I'll focus myself. Don't worry. Okay. Recent poll, okay, not that long ago, nearly 70% of Americans said they believe the people are ruder now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Only 9% of adults are able to say the children they saw in public were respectful towards adults. That means 91% of people in this country say that the norm of kids is chutzpah, okay? Chutzpah yaske, right? The Gemara says it so beautifully, right? Now, how does it show itself in the classroom? In 2004, more than 1 in 3 teachers told the national pollsters that they had serious aversion or knew a colleague who had left because of intolerable student behavior. And some of you may have stories like this, maybe not in your settings, but this is something that I hear about a lot. Nearly 8 in 10 teachers, okay, said their students were quick to remind them that they had rights or that their parents could sue if they were too harshly disciplined. More than half said they ended up being soft on this one because they can't count on parents or schools to support them. Now, is that the norm in our world? I don't know. I hope not. But, unfortunately, from the nods of many of your heads, okay, I see that this is not alien. This is not alien in our world. We're not immune from it. There's a new, and that's what kids, you know, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to talk about parenting. I said this in Shari. Parenting not, he says, you guys are the mechanchen. He says, parents are mashpia. And what does it mean to be a mashpia? What is the Hebrew word for mashpia? What's the root of the word mashpia? It's shipua, a ramp. It's what ramps down. It's what ramps down. If the ramp in kids' homes is supporting the child over the teacher, okay, then obviously, and if the ramp in the child's home is exposure to a culture of chutzpah, that's going to be the default setting. So we're not such good right-hand specialists. We're good left-hand specialists. We're not such good right-hand specialists. Okay, so that's just by way of introduction in terms of that component. Is that the reason? Will this alone make a kid a serious problem? Of course not. But this interacting with the netiyah because of wiring, a netiyah in that direction, that will. And don't worry, I'm going to get into the stuff you talked about as I move on with this. Okay, look, external influences, again, I don't want to bore you with too much detail here. You know all of this, but I just want to talk about the analogy. It's the frog in the beaker analogy. Take a frog, throw it in a beaker of boiling water, it'll jump out and save its life. Take the same frog, throw it in a beaker of water that's normal temperature over a low simmering fire that goes up a degree at a time, it'll boil to death, right? Little by little by little, it'll get hotter and hotter and hotter, it'll boil to death. What's the nimshel? Nimshel says we're too close to it to see it. But there's an incredible change in what kids are exposed to, especially on the internet. I was thinking, I went to Masifta of Long Beach, okay? I was there in the first years of the yeshiva, right? It was a Lakewood-style yeshiva. And I thought about what would it have taken to see pornography as a Talmud in the Masifta of Long Beach in the early or mid-1960s, okay, when I went there. Okay, 1964, 1965, as the yeshiva was starting. So if you wanted to see pornography, there were guys that would talk about, you know, let's go get a Playboy. Okay? They talk, I'm telling you. Well, this is what guys would sometimes talk about. And then people would talk and they'd say, wait a second, we can't do it here. It'd be a terrible Chilul Hashem. Does anybody have like a special coat and a hat to wear so nobody will know? And maybe we could go into Oceanside, into Island Park where they won't recognize. And then you'd have to go and you'd have to, with your squeaky voice, say, can you give me that Playboy that's on the top shelf? Okay? in my years there in the yeshiva, I'm telling you, from what I knew, I'm not sure I would have known it if I said, nobody ever had the guts to get any pornography. I never saw any inappropriate material in the walls of the Masifta. Okay? Now, compare that to a boy living at home today. Compare what it takes. So there, in order to do it, you'd have to have meetings and plan it and the shame. And ultimately, you're, in spite of that incredibly strong Yetzer Hara, you would, okay? Compare that to today. Do you know? Look at this statistic, okay? Here's the statistic. Average age of internet exposure to pornography is 11, okay? 70% of kids say they've accidentally stumbled on pornography. So these are, if you have a home where you have the internet, these are just plain the statistics. 20% say that they've had unwanted solicitation, and 1 in 4 report that they were significantly distressed by the event. But even more important than that, look at this slide. Most parents think that they have clear rules on how to deal with the internet. But you ask the children of these parents, and look what happens. So 92% of parents said they have established rules for their child's internet use. Only 65% said they have established rules for internet use. Same families. Okay? So most parents think they have a handle on it. Most kids are laughing at them. And that's why, when I think about the frog in the beaker, think of the Satmar Rebbe in 1950, right? Who said he was worried about his chassidim, who saw more in one bus ride from Williamsburg to Manhattan than their grandparents saw in a lifetime in the shtetl. This was 1950, okay? 1950. What a kal v'chomer for today. And we're too close to it. It's happening too gradually for us to see it. And that's a piece of this also, because it changes the default setting. So there's a lot going on out there that we're too close to see. But there's a lot going on. I'll tell you what I see it in my office. In my office, I'll sometimes see a Five Towns kid or a Great Neck kid who comes from a very affluent background. By the way, the highest rate of depression in this country is in affluent adolescents. It's called affluenza. Okay? Affluenza, it's a well-known phenomenon, and it makes sense. It's a state of magiali. I have it coming to me. You know, I shall. And sometimes I'll see in the same day, I'll see back-to-back a Five Towns kid or a Great Neck kid. I'm not saying, I grew up here, so I'm allowed to say. So I'll see a Five Towns kid, I can say it. Okay? So I'll see a kid from this neighborhood, and then I'll see a kid who they'll bus in, you know, the parents don't want to see anybody who they might know, so they figure my office out here is safe. So they'll schlep into Great Neck to see me, and they'll come in from New Square or they'll come in from Williamsburg, and I'll sit with one of those kids who's leading such a sheltered life. And I got news to you. They have problems. I'm not saying there aren't problems. And sometimes very serious problems. But you know something? They're neshamas. There's a, you know, we say every morning, Elokai neshama shenasata b'tahorahi. There's a purity to their neshamas that you just feel right away. You can get them excited so much easier. There's something that is almost palpable about the fact that they've been sheltered from the schmutz that our kids see. Okay. So is that a piece of this? Yeah, I think so. I think it's a piece of it. It's a background music in terms of what's happening. Okay? You want to see that? This is from the walls of Mea Sharim. Okay? It shows Bir Net. Chaval Shalos Sisi Yisrael Lefnei Shnatayim. Ay Baruch Hashem Shanasam Liyasa Ometz, etc., etc. And it shows them burning the internet. Now, that's not such an easy... Some communities have taken this approach. They've taken the Bir Net approach. Okay? So Lakewood has tried to do it, although they've made an exception for those in Lakewood who have businesses that use the internet, which I'm not sure what percentage that is. And then I hear the most popular new business in Lakewood is the business of having kids come to your house to watch the internet. You know, other kids from other neighborhoods. But the reality is that unfortunately. Unfortunately, many kids, and by the way, I'm not against, if you could do it, I think, and I'm very, Baruch Hashem, I've had the privilege of being able to work closely with Ramatzio Salman on a number of issues, and I've really come to know him and have incredible respect for him. He's an unbelievable person. And if you could do it, that's great. The problem is, just know that here in this community, what the research seems to be showing is that if you get rid of the internet in your house, okay, a very high percentage of kids will find it in a friend's house, or will find it in their father's office, or will find it somehow in the library. I teach now in Yeshiva University. One of my favorite pastimes in Yeshiva is to go to the top floor of the library there. They have an incredible library, a very rare svarim. And Hasidim come from all over to go to that library to see the very rare svarim when they're, you know. And the same Hasidim, not all of them, but some of them spend much more time, you know, there's free internet access there with probably 50 computers on that floor, and they spend a lot of time, I see, on the internet when they're visiting the library, okay? Why? It's too tempting. So the answer, what's the answer? The answer in part is what the research seems to show is if you could control it, great. You should certainly not have it in your child's room. But the real answer is you need words for it. It needs to be in the if you're living in a modern community such as this, you need to monitor it in the context of a good relationship is the key thing. So that if a child comes across something they shouldn't, they should feel they could come to you, talk about it, not be yelled at about it, and be able to talk it out, because that's the best antidote. Okay? And to be on top of it. It's that balance. Again, it's the balance between the small dochavim and makarevas. Okay. Now, let me move on. You were gonna say something or? Okay, let's move on.
With the internet, a little bit of a contradiction. I tell you that you shouldn't have internet, and then from this companies advertise on it, you know, have websites on it, you know, Arts World or, you know, I just get very confused because here, you know, Mishad Echad is telling you to get rid of it, but yet, that, you know, people who are reliable have websites and advertising on it. I never understood.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And, you know, it's interesting because there's that duality in the internet. I mean, those of you who are Daf Yomi people know, or just in general, I use the internet on a regular basis for learning, you know. So you could hear unbelievable shiurim for Daf Yomi. You could get, if you want to do a Dvar Torah in an area and you get good at searching for certain stuff, it's an incredible force. It can be an incredible force for the good, okay? Art Scroll does unbelievable good by reaching out to a huge population of people who are very comfortable with the internet. And you're right, there is somewhat of a mixed message there, but on the other hand, you could argue, I once had a guy come, I'm seeing somebody from a very wealthy family in the North Shore of Long Island. I don't think they were Jewish. They had a last name that didn't sound Jewish at all. And it was always the mother bringing him, because the father was a very famous, very prominent physician at Ivy League Medical School. And one day, I come into my waiting room after I finish seeing the kid, and I see the father sitting down, no yarmulke, and he's learning the Schottenstein edition of the Daf Yomi. So he's learning like Gemara, I don't know, like Bava Kamma or something. So it's like the middle of the cycle. I didn't even know this guy was Jewish. I said, "What are you doing?" And he says to me, he looks up at me, and he says, "Nothing." He said, "I never had a Jewish background." He said, "I'm Jewish." I had no idea he was Jewish. So I never had any kind of Jewish education. He said, "I read an article in the Times," this was last cycle, "about this thing at the garden for finishing the Talmud." He said, "I was always curious about the Talmud. So I went out and I bought," they said something about Art Scroll, "I went out and I bought the Talmud." He said, "I fell in love with it." And he looks at me and he says, "You know something? I'm just telling you one thing." He says, "I'm a persistent guy. I'm going to make it to the garden the next time." This guy never learned in his day, couldn't read Hebrew. Okay? Now, what does it mean he's got? Now, so obviously, that's a force, and you could argue it, but you're right, there's tremendous ambivalence, because it could be a tremendous force for the good, it could be a tremendous force that's problematic. The problem is, if we're raising our children in an area where they have easy access, because of friends having easy access, I think part of the answer has to be with having a good, open communication with them about what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, so
schools even we have the internet, school with the filters which every kid of course can get around their own way. What is the responsibility of the educators of the schools towards the internet?
Yeah. so the question is,
yeah,
yeah, we can easily. I'll just say, so the question is what's the responsibility of the schools? And there, the first thing is safety first. So I know schools, in terms of my space, I know a school, Yeshiva High School for Girls, that they had their technology teacher go through MySpace, find the name of every girl in their school. It's very easy to do. You can search for schools. And they found the name of every girl, girl in the school on MySpace, and they called her in and made her close her account. And that makes sense, because that's safety. That's safety. I know they have ways around it. But you know what? But it gave a message to the girls. Most girls, in other words, it gave a message. It gave a message. So there's messages of safety. It gave a message to the parents. The bottom line, though, is I think that schools have a certain responsibility to talk it out. You name the monster. The research shows, for example, that every year there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of inappropriate material that's shown on television sitcoms. So there's a place called the Kaiser Family Foundation that tracks this every year. Every year. If I showed you the statistics, they're mind-boggling. They're really mind-boggling. In terms of how much more, the frog in the beaker, the temperature is going up tremendously. But there's some new interesting statistics that I find fascinating coming out. One statistic that just came out last year, for the first time ever, more than half of young adults in this country, in the secular world, in the general world, wish they had waited longer till they became physically active with their partners. They wish they had waited longer. Okay? Think of the frog in the beaker. There's a backlash. Most kids who become physically pulled into a relationship, okay, when they're in high school or even when they're not ready for it when they're younger, they actually, their grades plummet a year later. There's a lot of very interesting information that we could connect to kids with. That's just one example. I show kids that study. I show the kids, say, what do you think? Why do you think more than half of kids wish they had waited till they were older? What's that about? And then I get a discussion going with them. It's very easy. Girls and guys both very much want to discuss this stuff. The research shows that they're dying to discuss it. They're dying to discuss it. And even though most adolescents won't be caught dead hanging out with their parents, when you go into Chadrei Chadorim, when you really go deep into their psyches, they very much say that they wish that they could have open discussions with their parents. And the number one person they would go to is their parents, not necessarily their educators. So part, I think, of what schools could do is to educate parents, because that's where the real chinuch has to be. That's part of it. Another part of it, though, is I think it has to be a partnership. And I think that to the extent that a Rebbe could have a class where they sit down and talk about this stuff, because kids are dying to talk about it. But you talk about it in a serious way, not just from a halachic standpoint, but you talk about it from the standpoint, adolescents in particular, why not mind what they're about? If you had a picture of the mattering map of the typical adolescent, we know how a boy's brain would look, okay? Be filled with certain thoughts that are incredibly powerful. And we know what a girl's brain would look like also, okay, in terms of what they, and you know, but you know something? The reality is that they're looking for guidance. There's an internet site called lockers.net. It has some people upset because it's for modern Orthodox adolescents who talk about these issues. They talk about doubts about emunah. They talk about their struggles with you know, being careful about negiah and stuff like that. And it's monitored. There are some rabbanim who monitor it. There are mental health people who monitor it. And they've fortunately been able to pick up a number of seriously suicidal kids on that site. But what's interesting about it is they're dying for input from adults. They want input. They want to be able to talk about it. It's what adolescents want hadracha. They don't want preaching, and they don't want it all to come from the Shulchan Aruch. They want to understand it. Now, frankly, I think that you all were probably not trained in how to talk to them about this stuff. And largely, that's a failure of the schools of education. It's a failure maybe of the way certain of the people in our community who are responsible for training teachers have trained teachers. But we have to, it's a much more complicated world, you know? And to learn how to talk to kids about this is something that we have to learn how to do. Because they want it desperately. I know, if I sit down with a group of adolescent kids and get them to talk about this, it's the easiest talk. I don't even have to do much work. I just ask a couple of key questions, get them to talk about it, and get them thinking about it, and then I share with them some of the information about why, you know, what is it that's behind this, and they're looking for something that makes sense to them. Now, I'm not saying they don't have to accept the chukav. I'm not saying they have to understand everything. I'm saying, but the way the adolescent brain works is they're looking for meaning, they're looking for understanding, they're looking for firm Christ. Look what happens to them when they go to Eretz Yisrael and are given the right kind of atmosphere. They come alive, okay? Anyway, but I hear what you're saying. That's the talk in itself. Let me do this. I'll make yours the last comment, and then I want to move on to other stuff. Yeah.
Sorry,
sure.
Would you mind speaking for a few minutes about how to communicate with the kids?
About how to what?
How to communicate with the kids.
Yeah, so the question is how do you communicate with kids? So let me go to that, and I'll use this as a springboard for it. I was going to get to it after this section, so let me just use it as you know. We know that children, what is it that's associated with kids internalizing? Okay, what is it that leads to becoming a mensch? Okay, what is it that leads to kids having a good set of values? You know, right, there's this beautiful gematria, it's my favorite gematria, it's the gematria for the word ahava is the same as the gematria for the word da'aga, okay? Right? Worry, right? Love and worry are inextricably intertwined, and there's no parent, I think, who raises children without worrying about them. And I don't think there's any parent, there used to be the old style magidim, used to at Ne'ila, a well-known drusha at Ne'ila was, if you take a look at the art scrolls, Machzorim, have adopted this. What would they do? There was in the old style Mahsarim, and now in Art Scroll, there's at the height of Kedusha during the year. So right, it's during the Shemona Esrei for Yom Kippur, for Musa, for Shacharis, on Rosh Hashanah, on at Ne'ilah. Well, not at Ne'ilah, but there's a very interesting psychological test. What's the psychological test? The Chazan says Aye. Right? Chazan says Aye. And you have a choice that as the Chazan is prolonging the word Aye, you have a choice between three tefillahs, right? It's a great psychological test. So one tefillah is that you should have Osher Muflug, right? He wrote something, you should have Osher Muflug. You should be phenomenally wealthy. Second tefillah is what? Ruach HaKodesh, right? Divine inspiration. You should reach the heights of spirituality. And the third Yehiratzon is Banim Tovim Umuhuganim. And the old style Magidim used to look down at the Kehila and Ne'ila and say, I don't have to ask you, I don't have to ask anybody here what you asked for in the Yehiratzon. Because of course everybody secretly maybe craves the Osher Muflug. And maybe everybody also. Hopefully we crave the Ruach HaKodesh. But when it gets right down to it, and you're playing for keeps, and it's Yom Kippur, and the Chazan's saying Aye, I know what I say. I know what I say, right? I say the Banim Tovim Umuhu Ganim, and we all do. So also I'm going to say, let that be Yischus, because we're all picking the right Yehiratzon. Okay? Let that be Yischus for all of us. Okay? So every parent wants it. What goes wrong? What goes wrong? So what goes wrong is sometimes it's the pressures of life. It's the financial pressures. It's the fact that we don't have time. The ingredients that are associated with the kid growing up to be a Ben Tov and Muhugan, I don't know, and worthy, okay, this is what the research shows. Parents who find the balance between Smoldochavim and Karevas. Parents who are consistent. Parents who are there. Oh, you see that?
I don't even have dialogue. See that? I think there's some kind of dipping here. I have a great story about what once happened when I gave a talk, but I won't. Is there an internet connection in this building? There must be. Yes. Sure. See, let me finish this, and then we'll do a break.
Yeah, so I'll cut to the chase here. Okay, so let's go with this. parents who were there, time. It's the four ingredients. The four ingredients of Menschlichkeit in the longitudinal studies of what it takes to raise a Ben Tov Muhugan is time, a lot of time with the kids, okay? That's that beautiful Kutzker, right? On the Pasuk of at the end of Tehillim that says, Kachitzim Yagibar came b'nei anu'urim, right? So it compares raising children to being an archer. The Kutzker asks, what's the connection between being an archer and raising children? And he says, just like with an archer, the closer he holds the bow to his heart, the further and straighter the arrow will go, so too with raising our children. The closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter they'll go. That's time. Then it's also but a certain calmness. It's a discussion. Okay, what about communication? That's the key. What about communication? And here's the key. The research shows that listening carefully to a kid really makes a difference. Giving them words makes a difference, okay? The word ozen and the word maznayim, or a scale, come from the same etymology, okay? Right? There's something balancing about listening to a child. When they really feel heard, it does an enormous amount for them. It does an enormous amount for them. So to be understood, first understand. I know this is sounding trite in a way, but it's so true. If you want to be understood by one of your Talmidim, one of your Talmidos, first understand them. Listen to them, hear them. Does that matter? Is it too little? It's not. The research shows that just being, what's so powerful about a good mentoring program? You know what's so powerful about a good mentoring program? The research shows it's not what you say, it's not the content, it's being there. It's just being there. I have a friend who's a professor of psychiatry, first at Harvard, now at BU, who took a picture of the brain of a friend of his who was at 9/11 as the towers were crumbling. And he shows that when this friend, who happens to be a psychiatrist, was reliving the horrible day, had a flashback to it, Broca's area was shut down, meaning there were no words. He was stripped of words, okay? And what the research shows by the same doctor, Dr. Van der Kolk, is where does healing come from when you're going through the tough times of life? It comes from lighting up Broca's area. It's giving people words is what brings refuah. There's the beautiful Abayr Benel on Bayido Maron. He says, why use the word demimus? Why not Vayishkod Aaron? He says, Sheket is for when you know the answer and choose not to say it. Demimus is for when you yourself don't know the answer. And sometimes we tend to underestimate, especially in the Western culture, just listening in a way that the child knows that you care is what makes the difference. And research shows that over and over again in a way that I have to be reminded of. So it doesn't feel like it's enough. But you know what? If the child's not being listened to elsewhere, it makes a difference. Let me end this section with a story. I went to I was giving a talk at a homeless conference. Conference for the homeless. It's not, you didn't, I expected to go to the parking lot and see a bunch of homeless people. They didn't. They let me inside, and it was a big, beautiful hotel, and it was professionals working with the homeless. And the other speaker, the keynote speaker, was this guy, who is a famous guy. He's won an Emmy, he's won all kinds of awards. Brilliant guy, PhD, who is in charge of homeless policy for the whole country. Very well-spoken guy, fancy suit, he gets up there. And I didn't know anything about him. I had heard of his name, but I didn't know anything about him. And this is the way I'll end this section. He gets up and he says, let me tell you my story. He says, when I was 13, this guy says, I was living as an only child in the house with my parents. My father, he says, was a crack addict. And my mother was often abused at his hand. And one day, when I was 13 years old, in a coked-up rage, my father, right in front of me, killed my mother and then turned the gun on himself. And he said, I was a smart kid. I knew I didn't want to fall in the hands of the foster care system. I knew I didn't want to. So I ran away. I ran away, and I went from shelter to shelter to shelter, drifting for the next 2 years. I knew the second they'd see who I was, they'd catch me and put me in foster care. I didn't want freedom. He said, that was my life. He said, it wasn't much of a life for 2 years, age 13 to 15. He says, at age 15, I heard four words that forever changed my life. Oh, so I was listening, okay, four words. You know, we could sell this, right? I'll tell you the four words. He said, the four words were, how are you doing? And then he explained. He said, the director of a new shelter he had just run to comes over to him, puts his arm around him, and says, how you doing? He said there was something different about this guy. He wasn't just asking how you doing. He meant it. He wanted to listen to me. And I saw it. I saw it in his eyes. I saw it in his body movements. I saw it in his personality. This man wanted to listen. Okay? So he said, he started talking. He hadn't talked to anybody. This man lit up Broca's area, lit up his language centers. He started talking. And this man listened. He saw he was very smart, got him a scholarship to an excellent private high school. In turn, his intelligence got him a scholarship to a wonderful Ivy League college, and the rest is history. He said, but it all came from the four words of a man who was willing to listen. Okay? Ozen maznaim. Don't put it down. Okay? What's communication? Communication is listening. Once you listen, they're going to want to hear you also. But the key is listening.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.